Now, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with the past belief that many of us had in the church. In fact, it was taught as a part of the prophetic scheme, and that is that what we were going to witness in the future was a revival of the Holy Roman Empire dominated by Germany, and to include an amalgamation of 10 nations of Europe. And that particular power block was destined to come over and destroy the United States and take it in captivity. Of course, the sad part about it was setting dates on that particular prophetic scheme, and so when 1972 came along, even though it was later denied that dates had been set, everybody, or at least a goodly number of people, became so disillusioned with that failure prophecy to fulfill itself that they began to be dubious of everything. And of course, I think probably the major cause for what happened following 1972 was a direct result of the prophetic failure which occurred at that time. Now, I'm not prepared to say that there's anybody that really understands the proper prophetic scheme, certainly with respect to dates or anything of that nature, nor am I intending to say today that the church was wholly wrong or incorrect in the past with respect to what was thought about Europe. Mainly because in the vast amount of research that we've been doing in the last year or so, we have found that the idea of a United States of Europe was nothing new. It was promulgated clear back in the 1880s, even in some cases earlier, as a part of a scheme by very, very influential banking interests in the world who said that you could never have a united world unless you first had a united Europe. So the idea to bring about a united Europe has been fostered by highly influential circles for a considerable period of time, but it is only a step toward even a bigger union, which of course is ultimately the aim and goal of many influential people in the world, to bring about a one world form of government. Now, when Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the other prophets were prophesying for Israel back in that time period, I don't think we should assume for one moment that they were concocting prophecies based on the situation that they were pulling out of a cocked hat. In other words, when they said that Babylon was going to come, or that Assyria was going to come, or that Egypt was going to come, there was a Babylon, there was an Assyria, and there was an Egypt sitting there ready to come. And so if we're going to look at prophecy, we're going to have to look at a situation, and I think the book of Revelation will substantiate that very, very demonstrably. We're going to have to look at present situations and present world conditions. Now, we find in the book of Revelation a system described which is called Babylon the Great. Today I want to analyze to some degree, I don't say it again that we have the full answer, I think we probably have the bulk of it at this point. There may be some details that need to be filled in yet, but I do want to demonstrate that what is the most formidable political ideology in the world today, which affects virtually every nation on the face of the earth, has its roots in Babylon, and it is, in all likelihood, I don't see a Chinaman's chance, if I can use that terminology, for anything else to be other than that. It is going to play the major role as a political ideology in the world in which we're going to face in the next few years, or however much time we have left. Now, first of all, let's notice Revelation, the 17th chapter here, because this system is described in Revelation 13, it's also described in Revelation 17, and it is described in Revelation 18. And specifically, the system is anti-God. It is certainly anti-Christ. So I can say this unequivocally, that the particular system we're looking at, called Babylon the Great here, and what it all includes, is definitely anti-God, and it does not come from the Bible. Now we read here, at the time that Christ returns, or at the time this thing finally crystallizes into a definite condition and state that is going to affect Christians and the world in general, we find this statement made here in Revelation 17, verse 13. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. And they shall make war with the Lamb. And the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings. So the particular system we're talking about here, called Babylon the Great, is virtually opposed to God and to Christ and is going to attempt to stand in God's way to bring about the fulfillment of His plan and His purpose. So the system is anti-Christ, there's no doubt about it, and it is anti-God. Now, the system, of course, as we've already called your attention, goes way back. It is not a new innovation. Because the statement is made here how this very system, notice verse 20 here, verses 20 and 24, how this particular system has been responsible for the antagonism against God's truth and God's servants from the very beginning. Notice it here. Rejoice over her, thou heaven. This is Revelation 18, verse 20. And you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. So this system has been persecuting and has been an instrument of death and whatever else is involved in the scope of its antagonism against God's servants and against God's truth, going way back to the holy prophets and the apostles. Now, furthermore, this system is so evil that God, in a summary statement here, says this. The particular statement being made here is not limited to a given period of time, because this is just a blanket statement that holds this system responsible for all the bloodshed that was ever shed on the earth. What does it say? In her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth. Now, if we're going to look at a system that has its roots way back, and it is responsible for all the bloodshed that was shed on the earth, then we're going to have to go back to the very beginning to see its origin. Now, recognizing that fact, I think you will see the significance of Jesus' statement here in Matthew, the 23rd chapter. Because he makes a startling statement here, and in the light now of what history really shows to be the case, I think we will see the significance of it. Now, I've already mentioned in previous sermons that what is called Judaism and what was called Judaism in the time of Christ was not the original teaching of Moses. It was a Babylonian corruption that crept into the Jewish religion. It did not originate with the Jews. It originated much earlier than that. And it crept into the Jewish religion and it finally penetrated and took control of it. So by Christ's time, it was known as Phariseeism. It was based on the Talmud and the Kabbalah. I'm not going to explain that again because that's been covered in previous tapes. But I do want to call this to your attention. Here's Jesus now making a statement in his day to the religious leaders of his time who were sitting, as he called it, in the seat of Moses, and the religious leaders who, by the way, were the heirs of all the truth that God had given, and they had so perverted it. And this was now a summary of what was involved in Talmudism, Phariseeism, and Kabbalism. And this is what Jesus says. I want you to notice it. He looked at the Pharisees here. This is Matthew 23 and verse number 35. And he said, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zechariah, son of Zacharias, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. Now, what is that statement saying? Jesus could not say that the particular Jews who were involved in this problem in his day were the ones who were guilty, going clear back to the time of Abel. So he could only be talking about a particular system which they inherited and were a part of, and that the system itself was responsible for all the bloodshed shed on the earth, beginning with Abel. Now that's how far it goes back. All right, if it involved Cain and Abel, then it has to go right back to the very beginning. So where did it start? All right, it started in the Garden of Eden. I've made a number of statements in the past. They have not been specific, too specific, so maybe they sound almost like they're a shop worn, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on it except to call to your attention briefly what I've already said in the past concerning the first movement that was anti-God that began with Adam and Eve. And you'll recall what was said here. There are two sentences here, two verses that, in a nutshell, outline the basic heart and core of this system. Now, I think you will see the significance of it a lot more when you begin to realize that it has its political application. And that its political application is going to play a major part in the world in which we're living. Now, notice what he says here. The serpent said, he told the woman, actually he told her three things. And upon these three things, these three false premises here, then it is very easy to build the rest of the system into it, because they are an automatic result of what was said here. What was said here is that you shall not surely die. So here was the first teaching, the first false teaching given man, that he has an immortal soul. The second two things are said is this, that if you go ahead and eat of this fruit, then your eyes shall be opened. In other words, you will be enlightened and you will know good and evil. So the second point mentioned here is that divine revelation or enlightenment does not come from God. It comes by your own human experience, that you yourself can find out the truth. And then the third thing that is said here is, you shall be as gods. In other words, you are already a god. Now that sets the stage for every single false system that came following that. And it is also, before I'm finished today, I'll also demonstrate that that is what is the heart and core, believe it or not, of the communist ideology and the socialist ideology of today. Now, I don't want to be saying something that may be embarrassing, but I think it is certainly well put. Some authors have said, the only difference between communism and socialism is the difference between seduction and rape, because the end result is the same. And so you're looking at a system here which is the major political ideology of the entire world in which we're living today, which is either socialism or communism. The only difference between the two of those systems is the way the goal is attained. Now, since we see here that scholars use the term Gnosticism, which is simply a Greek word from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge, enlightenment, or understanding. And so the basis of every false ideology that is prevalent in the world today, which is contrary to God's law, has its roots right here in Genesis, the third chapter, and can be termed Gnosticism. In other words, it is a method of enlightenment. It is a method of finding the truth apart from God. God is shoved out of the picture and is not given any consideration. Now, based on that incident that occurred here in the book of Genesis, the third chapter, we know then the results that happened with respect to Cain and Abel. In Cain's case, it was a rejection of revealed knowledge and truth. He chose to try to serve God his own man-made way, and he was not going to serve God the way he was told to serve him. In fact, that is the basis of every religion except God's truth in the world today. Men have determined in their own mind how they're going to obey God, and they reject his instruction on how to do it. And, of course, the first murder was perpetrated by one who was jealous over that very issue. The first murder that was perpetrated on the earth then was perpetrated as a result of a religious motive. That's why I'm saying very plainly, there is no possible way to divorce politics from religion, even though we have tried to do it, that is, as a nation and as a country. Because every single political ideology is a direct result of a previous religious ideology, even including our system of government, which we call the Republican form of government, erroneously called democracy. The basis of that system of government, believe it or not, was the Bible teaching of the individuality of man. And the fact, as was taught by the founding fathers, those who govern best govern the least. In other words, the system was set up to allow as much freedom as possible and yet to still maintain law and order in a regulated society. The shift from the time the country was founded toward a totalitarian direction has probably shifted at least 90%, so that my guess would be we're somewhere between 90 to the 100 percentile, maybe even a little bit further, 95 to the 100 percentile, toward a totalitarian state. I believe that if the founding fathers of our country were resurrected and could see what was going on, another revolution would start, because that's how far it has drifted from the original principles and teachings of the forefathers. Although not all of them were godly men by any means, many of them were deists, atheists, and so forth, but they did recognize the necessity to allow as much freedom as possible and to not try to regulate the individual. Now, based on what happened then in Genesis, the third chapter, and what occurred then with Cain and Abel, I think we can safely conclude, based on Jesus' statement here then in Matthew, the 24th chapter, that the system that developed in the pre-flood world was probably a socialistic occult system. Because notice what Jesus said here in Matthew, the 24th chapter, and verse number 37. Jesus said, as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. So what conditions and what circumstances and the way people lived and the way people set up their lifestyles at that time period, Jesus said, were going to be a repetition in the day he returns. All we have to do is look at what is taking place in the world today and what has transpired in the political and economic scene, and I think we can pretty well say, we can pretty well guess what the case was before the flood. And of that civilization, God said it was so evil that every single thought of man's imagination and mind was only in an evil bent continually. Now, maybe we haven't seen it in its full blossom yet, and it may be a whole lot worse before it's over. But I think we can begin to get some kind of an insight now into what was really the prevailing problem in that day, because we can base it on what the prevailing problem in our day is today. Now, this system, the Bible calls it the daughter of Babylon. Same system from the same source. So it is essentially the same system. And this system we read of here in Revelation 17, beginning in verse number 1. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither. I will show thee the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. Now the past teaching, of course, was that that was the Catholic Church. That may partially be correct. The only reason I say that is when you're looking at what is called Gnosticism, you're looking at two aspects. Gnosticism always consisted of a philosophical aspect and a theurgic aspect, which means the practical aspect of the philosophy. In other words, how do you apply the philosophy of Gnosticism? And the application of the philosophy of Gnosticism was always applied in occultism. Now, what has happened to the world today in general? It has rejected the occult aspect. That is, the Western world has. That is, the majority have. So the word occult actually has taken on the meaning, if you look it up, it'll generally say hidden. But as one author said, it is rejected knowledge. It is that knowledge which has been rejected by the majority. Now, as the author goes on to say, it may not be incorrect knowledge, but it is knowledge that has not been accepted. And the reason it has not been accepted is because it is occult. Now, it's becoming increasingly popular. One book I read is called The Occult Explosion, and it shows what is happening in the United States and in the world today, where one author admits, in fact, this book right here, there are as many as 10 million practicing witches in the United States today. All you have to do is turn your TV set on or look at your TV guide, and how many nights of the week can you go by with not some aspect of occultism in some program, in some show? This is one of the primary methods used to brainwash the public to accept that. It then becomes acceptable, and then it becomes normal, then it becomes the majority. But that part, up to this point, has been largely rejected because it is rejected knowledge. The other aspect of Gnosticism has been accepted. That's the philosophical aspect. And that aspect has been accepted in every single religion in the world except the truth of God. And it has also been accepted in education, in various social aspects of our society. It has been accepted in the methods we think and reason. And so the philosophical aspect of Gnosticism has been largely accepted by the world. Now, what we call Christianity today then has accepted the philosophical aspects of Gnosticism, and for a good deal of the time, the major grouping in that so-called Christian atmosphere even accepted vast amounts of the occult part, but were cast out. So that what is accepted is Christianity today. What we call Christianity today in the Western world is, to a large degree, tainted by the philosophical side of Gnosticism. For example, why did all of you growing up in the church of your choice believe in the immortal soul? Is that biblical? Do you find it in the Bible? Not at all. In fact, every church historian will readily tell you that the doctrine of the immortality of the soul was in direct contradiction to the Jewish teaching of the resurrection of the dead. Also, for example, how many of you growing up in the church of your choice envisioned this great battle going on between Satan and God? And it was not until you came to a knowledge of the truth that you learned that Satan was not an equal with God. Rather, Satan is an inferior being who's allowed to do what he's allowed to do because he's serving a part of God's purpose and plan. And yet, the church of your choice led you to believe that this great struggle is going on between God and the devil, and somehow God is not able to suppress the devil and keep him down. So who's winning the battle? That's a Gnostic concept that was absorbed into the church, passed off into the Protestant churches, and it's a part of our thinking today. Also, for example, how many of you believe the law of God was done away with? That's a Gnostic concept that crept into the visible church and into Protestantism. So you see, you look at the three basic issues that involve everything we believed in the past in the church of our choice, and they're Gnostic. See, those are the philosophical aspects of Gnosticism, but most of us, of course, we may have been interested to a larger or lesser degree, maybe in some cases fearful. Most of us didn't tamper with the occult aspects of it. I remember a old prospector back up in Montana where I grew up. He was always looking for gold, and then he decided he would look for uranium, and never did find anything, but you know where he got most of his information on where to go and where to look? Once a week, he went down to Billings and went to the card reader and the palm reader. So a lot of people are very, very strongly affected by this occult aspect, and while it has been largely rejected, the philosophical aspect is what has been absorbed. So, as I started to say earlier, when we looked at this description here, of this great horror spoken of here, we were taught it was the Roman Catholic Church. All right, I'll go so far as to say this, the Roman Catholic Church is probably a part of it. But so are all the Protestant churches. So what's the difference? They're only a part of the overall thing, though, because this system goes on, as we've already seen, this system goes right back to the very beginning. And it says here, the kings of the earth have committed fornication. The inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Now, one of the things that was shocking to me, doing a lot of research on the subject, I was dumbfounded to find that in about the 1870s, in the Italian overthrow of the papal states and the establishment of Italy as a unified country, that during that time period, the Catholic Church came under the financial dominance of the House of Rothschild. And that the Rothschilds came right down and gave orders to the Roman Catholic Pope and told him what he could do or what he couldn't do, especially with respect to how the Jewish people were being treated in the ghettos. And then I just found out recently that of the billions of dollars that the Roman Catholic Church invests, guess who handles all of those funds and does all their investing for them? In Europe, the Rothschilds, and in the United States, the Rockefellers. So that ought to tell you a whole lot right there, that when you're looking at this great system spoken of here, you're looking at something that is not dominating the kings of the earth, because if you want to know who the kings of the earth are, the kings of the earth are the people who hold the purse. The people who have the power to control money. All right, now he talks about this woman here having 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple, scarlet, so forth. Describes all these abominations. Then it says here, upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Now, I'm not sure this is a complete answer, but at least in my own mind, it answers the question more so than it ever did before. And that is that we always pondered the significance and the meaning of that term, the mystery of iniquity. Now, the first mystery system that developed, that we have any knowledge of whatsoever, is that system that was developed by Semiramis after the death of Nimrod. This is covered to a good degree in Alexander Hislop's book, The Two Babylons, And he explains how it had to go underground with the overthrow of Nimrod and the restoration of the patriarchal system. That is, for a brief period of time. So it was a mystery. It was a religious system that was a mystery. Now, the only other mystery the Bible speaks of is the mystery of God. So the mystery of God, you know, Paul speaks of it a number of times in the New Testament, this mystery that God has given and revealed to us. In other words, how many people perceive and understand what life is all about, the purpose of life, where they're going, what they have to do to gain salvation? How many people understand that without the enlightenment of God's Word and the Holy Spirit entering their minds and giving them that truth? How many of you understood in the past? That mystery has been revealed to us through God's Word and through the Holy Spirit. It is a mystery of the great plan that God is working out. But there also is, in opposition to it, the mystery of iniquity. In other words, it is also a mysterious system that is unknown to most people, but it is a system of iniquity or lawlessness. It had its roots in Babylon. So this is called mystery, Babylon the Great. Now, if you look about yourself, if you look about the world today, how many nations on the face of the earth today exist apart from a socialist system, either a socialist or a communist system? There may be some small countries that have a certain degree of free enterprise, but I think I can safely say that every major nation in the world today, and particularly those who are controlling finance and industry, are either communist or socialist. And I think the inevitable conclusion we can come to is that if there are any other nations left on in the world today that are not communist or socialist, they will be. That is the system that has virtually engulfed the earth. It is a great economic system, and as I'm going to demonstrate today, it is also a religious system, even though it's called political. And it has its roots in Babylon. Now, this description is given here in verse number 9. It says, "Here's mine which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come." Now, I don't know the full meaning of that. I can only say what some people believe it is, and they may well be correct. Because if we're talking about a system called Babylon the Great, which has been carried down right on down to the time period in which we're living, and at the time John was writing it, said one is. Remember, John wrote the book of Revelation about 100 AD, 90 or 100 AD, and he said in his day, one is. That is, there's one existing right now today. The Roman Empire. And he said another is yet to come, so a world-encompassing system would develop in the future that is not yet here, but there had been five that had already existed. Meaning, of course, Babylon is the original system, and there were actually two Babylonian systems. There was the first Babylonian system, and then the second one. There was also Greece, and then there was the Greco-Macedonian Empire. All world-ruling systems. All that had their roots in Babylon, and their basic ideology and the premise for their existence went back to the original. And this woman has set astride every one of these systems. Now, we've always assumed that when you're talking about a woman here, this is talking about a church. That may be partly true. I think I would tend to carry it one step further and say that when you're talking about a woman here, you're talking about a religion. Because, you see, a church is only a reflection of a religion. So we're talking about a religious system that has virtually dominated every world-ruling empire from the beginning. And that system, of course, is Gnosticism. Now, I'm going to show you, before we're finished here, that its practical application in the political sense is exactly what we have in the world today. So it describes it here. It describes its various resurrections, and it said one is present, John said, and another is yet to come. So it's going to encompass the whole world. There's never been a world-ruling empire since the Roman Empire. When I say a world-ruling empire, I mean the known world in that time. Now, as I said earlier, we read in Revelation, the 17th chapter, that this system was going to fight God. So virtually going to fight God. It's anti-God and it's anti-Christ. Now, we will recall that in 1 John 4, John tells us what the Antichrist is. John says, every spirit that confesses, this is 1 John 4, verses 2 and 3, every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. Now that can be understood in two ways, but it certainly is correct in this sense. And that is that we already know, and I've demonstrated this a number of times, that it was the Gnostic religion that repudiated the fact that Jesus Christ came in the flesh. So the Antichrist has its roots in Gnosticism. And the manifestation of the various forms that it has taken are many, because as we read here in 1 John 2 and verse number 18, little children, it is the last time, and as you have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists. So the Antichrist is a system that rejected the visible, physical manifestation of Jesus Christ as God's Son in the flesh. That system was Gnosticism. Now, as we will continue here, I will demonstrate very plainly that that system also is responsible for communism, for socialism, and for fascism. In fact, I was rather shocked. I've read at least three complete books on the subject of fascism, and I found out that what fascism really was, it was a revival of paganism. That Adolf Hitler and the leading Nazis who were formulating that entire program were heavily involved in the occult, in astrology, in magic, and in witchcraft, and their hated enemies. The three enemies that they despised were Bolshevism, Christianity, and Judaism. And as one author put it, it was Gnosticism with a racial twist. And it was an attempt to restore the ancient pagan Nordic religion. But it was, in its thinking, it was Gnostic, plain and simple. Now, the only difference, then, between communism and fascism are this. Communism is international, whereas fascism was limited only to Germany. Now, of course, once the war started going, then the German war machine made a quick end to Europe in short order there, and it automatically became expensive as far as Europe was concerned. But in its original ideology and its original intent, fascism was not intended to be international, but communism was from the very beginning. But they're both socialism. You see, all socialism means is that it is in the hands of the government. The government is responsible and takes control of the means of production and the distribution of goods. In other words, it means the elimination of a competitive market. That's what was the case with Nazi Germany. That has also been the case of Russia and the communist countries. That is also the case with socialism. The only difference is that socialism, as I pointed out, is a method of seduction. It takes place over periods of time. And what we have in the United States today is called creeping socialism, and is a direct result of the Fabian socialism that was established in England in about, shortly after the first decade of the 20th century. So you can see that what we're talking about a system that God calls Antichrist, that has its roots in Babylon and also has a political application. All right, now what system is that? Well, to demonstrate that to you without any shadow of a doubt, I'm going to read just a few sections from three books that I brought with me today. This book is entitled The Gods of Atheism, written by a Roman Catholic priest by the name of Michelli. And it is a very well done book because it deals with every major philosopher in the 18th and 19th centuries, primarily the 19th century, because that's when these men really began to carry weight and to influence the thinking of the world. We have all heard it in the general term of German rationalism. This German rationalism that set the stage for what we know as the major thrust in respect to socialism and communism is Gnostic. Now, how do I know that? All right. We'll begin by Hegel. You've all heard of Hegel. He was a professor in Berlin, and he was probably the one who set the stage for all of the philosophers who followed him. He was, as it says here, Hegel would go beyond Christianity. In other words, there was an attempt. They were disillusioned. In fact, in every one of these cases, these main philosophers who formulated what we call the various political ideologies today all started out, at least as nominal Christians, and they became embittered and disillusioned with what was called Christianity. And so they turned to other avenues. Now, when you reject Christianity, or you reject at least what truth is known about Christianity, and you go to other directions, what other direction can you go to? There's only one. You're going to end up in some aspect of Gnosticism, one way or the other. All right, now what did Hegel say? Hegel demonstrated that the only valid God was dialectically evolving thought or spirit. Now, what that simply means is that when he uses the term dialectical, normally dialectical means conversations you're carrying. If you indulge in dialects, it means you have a very, very adept method of presentation so you can become involved in debates and argumentation and eventually win. But in this particular case, dialectic does not mean that. It means conflict. It means opposing forces in conflict. So that in this case, what it means is that he said the only valid God was these opposing forces, evolving thought or spirit, which gradually, inevitably, obtains and reveals itself in conceptual clarity. Now, what was he really saying? What he was saying is that God is finally being able to comprehend and grasp something. That's God. In other words, God was not an invisible spirit being and a personal entity in a specific location. God is just an evolving process of reasoning. Now, as the author goes on to say here, after all, was not this God a mere antithesis of the dialectical evolution of spirit? In other words, God is the exact opposite of the dialectical evolution of spirit. Hellenism, with its serene gods of immanence and order, was a thesis of evolving thought. Now, what did I tell you about Gnosticism a long time ago when we were going into this thing of the Grecian philosophers? I told you they all essentially believed the same thing. They had varieties in how they approached it and how they handled it and how they explained it. But they all believe essentially that God was not a personal being. In fact, Plato and Aristotle both believed that the planets were gods. And so what they all believed was that God was this, they called it in the Gnostic world, the Pleroma. Whereas in the Jewish community, as the same Gnostic concepts were accepted by the Jews beginning about 500 BC, they called it the En Sof. But it all is essentially the same thing, and that is that God is not a personal spirit being, that God was this kind of a manifestation of energy, force, and power that was unknowing, that could not be known, and that everything came from this God in the form of some kind of an emanation, which just simply means it would be comparable to what we would call spontaneous combustion if we were thinking in terms of evolution. And this emanation from God produced this demiurge, this secondary God, who in turn was the one who created the evil world. So that, as the author says here, quite candidly, Hellenism with its serene gods of immanence and order was the thesis of evolving thought. In other words, here's this mess up there, and it only represents a kind of a thought. And as it evolves, it materializes into various forms. Now, that's the basic teaching of Gnosticism. Now, as the author goes on to say here, it must be observed, that was Hegel's teaching. Now, the man that came after Hegel, who built a entire system on Hegel, was Feuerbach. Now, Feuerbach was a student of Hegel. And he disagreed with him in a certain area with respect to what the real solution should be, and he became the leader of what was called the left-wing Hegelians. And the left-wing Hegelians, as he taught here, Feuerbach does not divinize individual man in his particularity, But he identifies God with the essence of man or with humanity. So what did Feuerbach conclude? He concluded, to put it very succinctly, that man is God. In other words, he identifies God with the essence of man or with humanity, so that he taught that what God really was humanity. Now you begin to get some kind of an idea of what humanism involves. When you talk about humanism, you're really talking about the concept that man regards himself as God. Now let me ask you this question. Who was the first one to tell man that he was God? I just read it to you, didn't I? That's Gnosticism. It began in the Garden of Eden. So if you want to know the author of humanism, it's the devil. Now, the devil has always had his instrumentalities. Now, as it goes on to say here, Feuerbach's humanist atheism was immediately pressed into service by his star pupil, Karl Marx. So Karl Marx was a pupil of Feuerbach in the universities there in Germany. And as a foundation for the erection of the monolith of communism. So what is the author saying here? He is saying that communism came from Feuerbach via Marx. Now all we need to do is to see what Feuerbach's teaching was and what Marx was with respect to these original Gnostic thoughts, and it becomes very obvious what the root of modern-day communism and socialism really is. Feuerbach's cult of abstract man, Feuerbach said that he didn't try to find solutions. See, what Hegel said is the problem is with Christianity because it is only an illusion. And Feuerbach came back later and said, no, the problem is really not that. The problem is that what God is abstract man, or just humanity in a kind of a general term. So as it says here, Feuerbach's cult of abstract man became Marx's science of real men and their historical development. And so the halo of divinity, in other words, man was now made God, the halo of divinity was shifted from the head of abstract man, just a general term of humanity, shifted from abstract man to the brow of the proletariat. So now what became God in Marx's thinking? The working man, the proletariat. Now, you'd ask yourself, why would anyone want to believe that? Well, let me ask you this. If you didn't believe in God, what else could you believe in? If you're not going to believe in God, then your next best choice is to believe in man, isn't it? The only difference is, in Marx's case, he applied it to the working man. Because he saw, and as I'll get to this in a few moments, he saw that the struggle, remember, I pointed out that when you're looking at Gnosticism, you're looking at this concept of dualism. You remember, two equal but opposing forces. And this is reflected in all of nature. In fact, as I'll point out here in a few minutes, that's even where the battle of the sexes began. Two equal but opposing forces. And so what Marx did is he saw that the two opposing forces, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. So as he says here, the halo of divinity was shifted from the head of abstract man to the brow of the proletariat. Scientific socialism became the new humanist religion. So the ideas of Hegel and Feuerbach, refined by Marx, became the new humanism. So that socialism today is nothing more. Communism and socialism are humanism. Now, as he says here, Feuerbach's humanism was transformed into the militant atheism of social democracy. And here is the master illusion presented by the arch liar in the Garden of Eden. Man, experienced in good and evil, is a better man, is like God, nay, is God himself. Well, that's exactly what we've come to. So Feuerbach, as it says here, his edifice of thought is founded on the myth of an abstract, non-personal, merely mentally existing humanity. Now, if you were a Gnostic, and you automatically believed that God wasn't a personal being anyway, it was just the kind of an abstract intelligence up there, what would your logical conclusion be? It would be the same as Feuerbach. You would say that God is, as he says here, an abstract, non-personal, merely mentally existing humanity. He equates this non-being with God. That was Feuerbach's philosophy. What's its roots? Gnosticism, plain and simple. All right, now, when atheism takes the form of a social conspiracy to dethrone God, it takes as its communal mission the messianic goal of the secularization of every cell of society. In other words, what the author is saying there is that it is the aim and goal of communism to eradicate all religion from the face of the earth. All right, now following then, Feuerbach, we come to Karl Marx. Karl Marx received the keys to his communist kingdom from Hegel and Feuerbach. Ludwig Feuerbach supplied Marx with the key of his humanist, materialistic humanism. By revealing God to be the fictitious creation of man's sick conscience, Feuerbach denied the reality of God, of any transcendent, of any spirit. He argued that God did not create man, but that man created God out of his own warped imagination. Hence, only matter, nature, and man exist. In other words, there's absolutely no spiritual realm in anything. Life is simply made up of matter. In other words, only thing that really exists is that which is physical. And Marx eagerly accepted Feuerbach's proposition that everything is ultimately nothing but matter. So there's no God, there's no spirit, and there isn't any opportunity to rise above man's level. This is the sole result of human experience. See, what the Marxists did, they went one step further than various Gnostics who believed in the reincarnation concept, because large groups of Gnostics believed that the man was immortal, all right, but he continued to go through these processes, various reincarnations. And this is what you have in the teaching of India today and the various religions over there, where, you know, you might be born one life as a man, the next life you might be a beetle, and the next life maybe a rat or whatever, see. But you continue to go through these various forms of life. But Marx went one step further. He even denied that and said there wasn't any afterlife of any kind. But it comes from the same source. Now, listen to this. Socialism was a necessary outcome of the conflict between two classes. You see, I said, this concept of dualism is reflected in opposing forces in everything in nature. That is, the conflict between the powerful bourgeoisie and the rising proletariat. At the heart of every antagonism, matter, the sole reality of the universe, was essentially in motion, progressing inevitably upward in a spiral direction and constituting man's evolution in history. So what he believed is that man was only the end result of this evolutionary process that occurred. They teach it a little bit different than Darwin. They teach that it didn't happen in a progressive method, but merely by big jumps at a time. But communists do believe in a form of evolution. So man is a result of evolution, and man, by his work, eventually will resolve the conflict in the millennium of communist society. Now, Hegel taught it is a philosophy, that is, this dialectical materialism, it is a philosophy that all reality is in continued flux, that there is no immutable eternal truths, and consequently no science of metaphysics that studies stable essences and eternal things. Rather, change is eternal and proceeds by opposites opposing each other. Now, what is that if that isn't Gnosticism right down to the root? Now, that's the heart and core of the communist teaching. Now I'll give you a little bit more from another book here, which makes it even a little clearer, but I wanted to read this first. The major impact of Hegel's thought on Marx was its insight into the essential, active, essentially contradictory and hostile relation between thought and matter, between man and the world, between man and man. In other words, what that is saying is that the heart and core of the communist teaching is that there can be no solution to the world's problems without a struggle. Now, that's what Marx taught. Now, I'm going to read just a section or two here from The Naked Communist by Cleon Skousen. And here's what he says with respect to this law of opposites taught by the Gnostics. Remember, the law of opposites, we've already seen, was a Gnostic teaching that there are equal but opposing forces in all nature. Here's what they taught. Marx and Engels started with the observation that everything in existence is a combination of the unity of opposites. That is, it doesn't mean that they're united together, but they're always two things that oppose each other. Electricity is characterized by positive and negative charge. Atoms consist of protons and electrons, which are unified by contradictory forces. Each organic body has qualities of attraction and repulsion. Even human beings find through introspection that they are a unity of opposite qualities. Selfishness versus altruism, courage and cowardice, social traits and antisocial traits, humbleness and pride, masculinity and femininity. Everything is opposed. The communist conclusion is that everything in existence contains two mutually incompatible and exclusive, but nevertheless equally essential and indispensable parts or aspects. And this idea was borrowed from Georg Wilhelm Hegel, who said, contradiction in nature is the root of all motion and of all life. So what is he saying? Well, if I come to it here, I might not read it, but I'll just mention it here in case I don't. And that is, well, I'll come to it a little bit later on, and that is that this motion and this conflict is what creates life. It didn't come from God. So, at this point, the student is expected to understand that each thing in the universe is in a state of motion because it is a partial made up of opposite forces. Now, that being the case then, since these things destroy themselves, there has to be a destruction that occurs before you can have anything new. Now, carry that to the political sense, and what does that mean? That means you have to destroy the existing society before you can have a new one. Now, as the author goes on to say here, these laws of transformation, that is, this change that's going to be brought about by the communist masters, teach the following. Matter is a unity of opposites, which creates a conflict that makes it autodynamic and self-energizing. Therefore, matter does not need an outside source of power for its manifestation and motion. In other words, it automatically exists, and there was no God that had a part in it. Number two, through its pattern of constant negation or dying, and the example given is like when you plant a kernel of wheat in the ground, it dies before a new one comes up. So, through its pattern of constant negation or dying, nature tends to multiply itself and fills the universe with an orderly development or increase without requiring any guiding intelligence. So you apply that politically, and that means the old system has to be destroyed before you have a new one. And number three, through the law of transformation, matter is capable of producing new forms without the need of any creating or directing power outside of itself. Engels boasted that by the discovery of these laws, the last vestige of the Creator external to the world is obliterated. So you see, the communist ideology is nothing more than the original teaching of Gnostic dualism, and in this case has gone so far as to even reject any God whatsoever, and all of the world's problems are going to be solved by man accomplishing it himself. As he says here, communist intellectuals believe that everything in existence came about as a result of ceaseless motion among the forces of nature. Everything is a product of accumulated accident. There is no design, there is no law, there is no God, there is only matter and force in nature. As for man, the communist philosopher teaches that he is a graduate animal, an accident of nature like all other life forms. Nevertheless, man is supposed to have the accidental good fortune to possess the highest intelligence in existence. And this is what makes him the real God in the universe. As Feuerbach said, the turning point in history will be the moment man becomes aware that the only God of man is man himself. So there's communist humanism. Now, that being the case, as I've already demonstrated, if man is supposed to be the highest intelligence in existence, then it becomes his manifest duty to remake the world. Now, if you were a communist and you were going to remake the world, how would you do it? You would make it in a communist form, wouldn't you? So what does that mean to any other religion? What does that mean as far as any other political ideology is concerned? Well, you ought to know the answer to that. Marx believed this task was the inescapable responsibility of the communist leaders, since they are the only ones who have a truly scientific understanding of social and economic progress. Marx and Engels accepted the fact that the remaking of the world will have to be a cruel and ruthless task, that it will involve the destruction of all who stand in the way. So So now you know why communism is militant. It is militant because it is the basic philosophy and belief of communism that change cannot come except as a result of conflict. And that conflict is reflected in the entirety of nature. And since man is only an intelligent animal, and since communists are the ones who really have all the laws of truth, it's their right to change society the way they see fit. Now, when you begin to realize that communism is associated with socialism, and that both socialism and communism are a system to go back to Babylon, what is that telling you about Babylon the Great in our time period today? See, that's why we can say that when we're looking at fascism, and we're saying the whole answer is answered in fascism or Roman Catholicism, we're only looking at a small part of the whole thing. Because, you see, it is not fascism that is the political ideology in the world in which we're living today. It's communism and socialism. All right, that being the case, how do we know that communism, that is the political communism that I'm talking about today, that is where the state has the sole right to be responsible for the manufacture and distribution of goods, where there is no what we call free enterprise system, how do we know that that system goes back to Babylon? All right, here's a book entitled The Return of the Puritans, and the author quotes the Russian author Solzhenitsyn. Before the quote from Solzhenitsyn, the author says, in this early city, that is Babel or Babylon, on the site of an occult shrine, a pattern of life which set up, which has persisted in the world system ever since. Both banking and usury are commonly believed to have originated in Babylon. Now, I've read several sources on that. In fact, it was associated with the religion and with the temples because the religions of that time owned vast amounts of wealth, and they were the ones that had the monetary control and the monetary power. And so as a result, the temples were the places where the various forms of money were held, and then in turn, the system of usury developed there, because I think you're all familiar enough with banking to know that a bank only has to hold in about 10 or 15% of its total assets in a solid form, and it can in turn then lend money on that, because at any given time, that amount of money will be retained there and the rest will be circulated. In other words, what you can do is, you could put $10 in the bank and then in turn issue credit for $50 to somebody. And then you keep compounding that and what you have. In fact, one author said that the actual amount of money that we have in circulation in the United States, I'm talking about whether we're talking about silver, the base coins as we have today, or dollar bills, or whatever the case is. The amount of money that is actually in circulation that is used by the people for exchange, used as legal tender for exchange, in comparison to the amount of money that has been created in the forms of fiat money and credit, the amount of money that is in circulation is only 2% of the total. 98% of it is fiat money. In other words, it only exists in paperwork or in a computer. So banking is associated with this system, as from the very beginning. Both banking and usury are commonly believed to have originated in Babylon. Not so well known, however, is the fact that ancient Babylon evolved into a totalitarian socialist state. Solzhenitsyn's fascinating book entitled From Under the Rubble makes it clear in the chapter on Ur and Babylon in the 21st and 22nd centuries B.C., 2,100 years B.C. Here's what Solzhenitsyn said in his book, and I'm just going to read the quote. Archaeologists have found huge quantities of cuneiform tablets reflecting the economic life of the time. From these, we know that the basis of the economy remained the temple units. In other words, they controlled the regulation, the control, and the manufacture of money, so they were the heart and core of the system, just like modern banks are today. But after the unification, they lost all their independence and became cells in a unified state economy. So what do you have? You have exactly what we have in the United States today, and in fact, in every major country in the world. You have a central bank. We have a central bank in the United States. It's called the Federal Reserve. It issues and creates money. It can cause it to depreciate. It can cause it to raise in level, whatever the case may be. But it controls the money. It's a state organization. Oh, it really isn't a state organization. We think it's a state organization. It's owned by a private corporation because the government allowed the private corporation to do it. Agricultural workers, men, women, and children were divided into parties headed by overseers. There you see exactly what you find in communist China today. Forced labor camps. They worked all the year round, moving from one field to another and receiving seed, grain, tools, and draft animals from temple and state stores. So the state supplied their needs. Just like you have in any socialist communist state. Similarly, in groups under a commander, they used to go to the stores for their food. The family was not regarded as an economic unit. What has happened in communist countries today? The family is no longer regarded as an economic unit. Provision was issued not to the head of the family, but to each worker, or more often to the commander. The bondage of large classes of the population is highlighted by the numerous documents concerning fugitives. So people ran away. These documents named the fugitives and their relatives, and they concern not only barbers or the sons of shepherds, but also priests and their sons. This picture of life of the workers open with regular statements about the death rate for the removal from food lists. One document declares a 10% mortality among its workers, another 14%, yet another 28%. Mortality was particularly high among women and children who were employed in the heaviest work, such as hauling. That's the end of Solzhenitsyn's statement, and as the author adds here, is it any wonder that God called Abraham out of such a system? The system Scripture identifies as Babylon then has the following characteristics. It's based on pride of man seeking to glorify himself in collusion with a false god and an occult practice. It is also a city where individualism is suppressed and world government sought. Eventually, it degenerated into a totalitarian socialist state, which destroyed the family, abolished individual property, used slave labor, was indifferent to human life, and exalted banking and money, especially gold. Sound familiar? So when we're looking at Babylon the Great, as we find it described here in Revelation, the 17th and 18th chapters, what are we looking at? We're looking at a system that goes right back to Babylon, and it is the system in the world today. Now, this system, the Bible has some things to say about what it's going to do to God's people. I won't spend a whole lot on this, but I will just read one or two portions here to give you the idea. We find a system described at the time of the end in the book of Daniel. And it says in this system, notice it here in verse 23 of Daniel, the 8th chapter. Verse 17 shows it's the time of the end. And what does it say? In the latter time of their kingdom. And the time of the end is mentioned here in verse 17. When the transgressors have come to a full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding shall stand up, and dark sentences shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, he shall prosper in practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall he destroy many, and he shall stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. So this is actually talking about an individual who's going to stand up and fight Christ. But what is it going to do to God's people? So you see, this system is absolutely against God's people, and it is against anybody who attempts to obey God and to follow his commandments and his laws. Now, I just want to read one statement here in closing, because this is what the author says in this book I read from a while ago called The Gods of Atheism. And this is what socialism and communism amount to. Remember, the only difference between the two of them is the difference between seduction and rape. The aim and goal is the same. So as it says here, work, man's greatest form of revolution, seeks to restore the divinity in man. And the condition imposed by the three tyrants mentioned above, and these are the three tyrants that communism and socialism literally despise. What are they? God, supernaturalism, and capitalism. Now, I should make one thing clear about capitalism, because this is mentioned several places where I've read this. Whenever you think that communism is opposed to capitalism, whatever you do, do not think of international banking. Because communism is not opposed to international banking. In fact, international banking has supported it and financed it. When communists are talking about capitalism, they're talking about anybody who is involved in a free enterprise system who does not come under the control of the state. But if you're modern-day financing today, if you're international banking today, you control the state. So the truth of the matter is that international banking and communism are bedfellows and have been for some time. So whenever you hear the term that communists are opposed to capitalism, they are not opposed to international banking. They're only opposed to industry and those things that they cannot control because they want to control the production and the distribution of goods, supposedly for the benefit and the good of all. Those are their enemies. And then the author here quotes Karl Marx, and here's what Karl Marx says. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is required for their real happiness. So the requirement of communism, Karl Marx stated here plainly, is the abolition of religion. Now, I think in the light of that and what I've demonstrated to you, show very plainly then that communism is a part. I don't think it's the only part, but it is a major part of what we call Babylon the Great today. Socialism and communism, the world political system, which is the practical application in the political sense of the original Gnostic system that began, first of all, in the Garden of Eden, was perpetrated by Nimrod and has been carried up through every system to our time today. And that system is the archenemy of truth, and it is the archenemy of God's people. Now, once we recognize that fact, we can see why the Bible says it is going to be so necessary for those who are God's people to qualify and to be given a place of safety and to be overcomers to the point where, as Jesus says, they can stand before the Son of Man.